A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
From the Independent Producer Project and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. You know, there's this animal that lives in my house. It lives there because I let it live there. I guess it's a she, really. Her name is Lucy. She's still an animal, though. She's the first dog I've ever had as an adult, and because of that, maybe, I'm a little cynical of her motives, to be honest. We got Lucy from a pet rescue place, so she owes me her life. She's a small mutt, but she could pass for a scruffy Maltipoo if she had to. Well, somewhere in her life, Lucy figured out that if she sits and stares at someone long enough, good things will happen. She'll get treats, she'll get petting and attention, she'll get walks. I don't think she intellectually understands that humans respond to her staring because she looks like a little fluffy stuffed animal come to life. She may not know that. She just knows that it works. My family thinks Lucy is motivated by her love for us, but I'm skeptical. When Lucy licks the tears away from my children's faces when they cry, the kids think she's trying to make them happy. I suspect it's because she likes the taste of salt. Lucy's cuteness is her superpower. We let her do almost anything, go anywhere. One of her primary jobs is this. She jumps on the bed and wakes up my wife. Every morning. Lucy is so excited when we get to this point of the morning routine. If I didn't open the bedroom door fast enough, she would just slam headfirst right into the closed door. You know, in her animal brain, I think Lucy does understand that I'm the alpha dog in my house. But when she jumps around on the bed, the place where I sleep, I think she thinks that she's getting one over on me. This week on Unfictional, the animal inside. And the animals who live inside our house generally have a pretty low bar for staying there. Two things, really. Don't poop on the floor, and don't bite anybody. But Kirby, the dog in Chris Peeler's story, is like a family relative at a holiday dinner who can turn on you at a moment's notice. Not that anybody was going to talk about it or anything. That's just the way it was in the Peeler family. From KCRW.com, it's Unfictional and Kirby the Biter.
My family spent this past Christmas in my parents' house in Pittsburgh. It was me and my wife, my mom and dad, my brother and his wife, and their three kids. We gave presents, we ate too much candy, we watched sports. But the best part was that four of us got bitten by my parents' dog, Kirby. Kirby is a male Jack Russell. He is 17 pounds of pure muscle, who is sweet and loyal, except when he's sinking his teeth into you. Kirby is my parents' 13th Jack Russell. The first was Casey, who loved licking people's faces and killing rodents. She once dug through the inch-thick wall-to-wall carpet trying to burrow under a door and murder our family's guinea pigs. To give you an idea of how the Peeler family deals with dogs, our response was to get rid of the guinea pigs and put in hardwood floors instead. Casey's son, Hugo, was the one puppy from his litter who no one wanted. So we kept him, and he spent his entire life either sitting in my mom's lap or hiding under a chest of drawers. And I don't even want to get into the grisly deaths of the puppies that came from the litter that Casey and Hugo had together. Our house was like a telenovela for terriers. After their 12th Jack Russell, Max, just ran away one day, never to be seen again. Mom and Dad actually took a break and adopted an enormous teenage golden retriever named Layla. Layla was more like a beanbag chair than a dog, but she only lived a few years with them. Soon enough, Dad was back at the Jack Russell breeder with strict instructions to pick only the most docile female. So, of course, he came home with Kirby, very much a male, and who is as soft and yielding as a fist. Now, the great cliche is that dogs start to look like their owners, but I think it goes deeper than that. Dogs are hardwired for empathy, and they're just sponges for tension. So Kirby is very much a peeler. My family doesn't do big, loud fighting. Instead, we let our worries and grievances fester and funnel all our hostility into squabbling about food preparation. So when we arrived in Pittsburgh, we didn't talk about what we're going to do about my dad, who has Parkinson's disease, and had fallen down the stairs at Thanksgiving, cutting his head so badly that the wound was still weepy at Christmas. Making the practical point that my parents needed to sell the house that they'd lived in for 45 years would have opened the floodgates of conflict. So instead, we all crammed into the kitchen and asked each other things like, "Is that asparagus ready yet? Do you have to use all the burners? And will people please sit down so we can eat before everything congeals?" And Kirby skittered from person to person, ears forward, nose twitching, taking it all in. 3 days before Christmas, Kirby bit my older brother, Michael. As Michael testified later, he was standing in the kitchen when Kirby ran up behind him and bit his calf. I say testified because every dog bite immediately becomes a crime scene. The actual act happens so quickly that eyewitnesses never quite agree about what really happened. And then everyone starts looking for motives. I said that Kirby was probably threatened by Michael, who at 5'11 is the tallest one in the family and also the closest thing we have to an alpha male. Mom felt that Michael had gotten between Kirby and his food. So after the first bite, Mom took the precaution of closing Kirby in his crate whenever we were preparing food. But it was too late. Kirby had developed a taste for peeler flesh. Seeing Kirby bite Michael put me on edge because it reminded me of our old neighbor's dog, a pure white husky named Shonda. When I was 6 or 7, Shonda bit me every chance she got. Once she caught me with my shirt off and bit me on the nipple. When Shonda was so old that all she could do was lie on her bed, the neighbors actually asked me to come visit because growling at me was the only thing that would make Shonda raise her head off the ground. So I avoided eye contact with Kirby and made sure that I was never in a room alone with him. And then he struck again. Mom was getting ready to go out. She put a couple of dog treats in her purse and went to get something in the kitchen, foolishly leaving her purse on the floor. Kirby immediately started digging through her purse, pawing at the keys and the checkbook and the lipstick. My 18-year-old nephew Owen put his hand on Kirby's back. Kirby turned and attacked, jaws snapping. Owen stepped back, but Kirby bit him once, twice, again. On the last bite, he grabbed onto Owen's pant leg and shook it like a rat whose neck he was determined to break. My mom rushed back into the living room and grabbed Kirby, just mortified. "I'm so sorry," she said to Owen. "Are you okay?" "Yes, ma'am," he said. "I'm fine." In her statement, Mom said, "It was my fault for being careless with the bag, and I feel terrible about it. I tried so hard to keep something like this from happening, and I'm sad to have failed." The spree wasn't over. On Christmas Eve, we had turkey, and Kirby was safely in his crate during all the food prep and dinner itself. But then, as we were doing dishes after dinner, somebody left the turkey carcass unattended on the kitchen table. My wife Anita caught Kirby crunching on a drumstick. She had learned from Owen, so she didn't touch the dog, but she did move the turkey. And out came the teeth, chomping in a frenzy. Anita was a sympathetic witness. "I was between him and the turkey," she said. "He didn't bite me. He bit the obstacle. If I was a dog, I would have bitten me. When Mom, Dad, and Kirby had gone to bed on Christmas Eve, the rest of us huddled in the living room. Like kids telling ghost stories, we sat in the dark and wondered who Kirby would target next. My niece Hallie, the sweetest 13-year-old on the planet, admitted that Kirby had already bitten her. She had been making cookies, and he nipped her on the calf. Clearly, the combination of family and food had incited Kirby to what Michael called an alarming amount of biting. Enough was enough. Hallie is the baby of the family. Biting her was just not okay. But what were we going to do about it? On Christmas Day, after Michael and his family had piled into their jam-packed SUV to drive back to North Carolina, Anita and I sat in the kitchen with Mom and Dad and had a long talk. We didn't talk about food preparation, and we didn't talk about Kirby. My wife, who is not a peeler, got Dad talking about how he still felt unsteady on his feet after his fall. We talked about how Mom could possibly balance working and caring for Dad. We talked about what they could do to prepare for the day when Dad won't be able to walk or feed himself anymore. I hated every second of this conversation. My stomach churned with acid. I felt raw, like every nerve in my body had been scraped with a grater. But we kept talking about money and sickness and death. And the whole time, Kirby slept quietly at my feet.
Chris Peeler is a playwright, comedian, and storyteller living in Los Angeles. You're listening to Unfictional on KCRW.com. I'm Bob Carlson, and today on the program, The Animal Inside. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, and tell your friends about the program if you could, too. Plus, all our old programs are at kcrw.com/unfictional. When Alex Ward was in college, he lived in a co-op. It was just a bunch of idealistic kids living together, trying to build the kind of world they wanted to live in. And then the rats showed up and ripped their idealism to shreds with their sharp little yellow teeth. From KCRW.com, it's Unfictional.
On the bathroom walls of the Lorax Manor, all these words and images flow into one another. There's a painting of Gandalf that's breathing out a plume of purple smoke that morphs into Walt Whitman's poem, I Hear America Singing. And then, just above the toilet paper roll, there's a single sentence written in black Sharpie. It reads, "This house voted democratically to poison rats on March 9th, 2009. Just below, in a ballpoint pen, someone's responded, "Thank God." The Lorax Manor is a co-op house in Eugene, Oregon. About 25 people live there at any one time. I lived there in 2008, when I was a junior in college, fresh-faced and ready to draw on walls. And the Lorax was all about living ethically and environmentally, like the tandem bike in the trailer that we used for supply runs or the flushing guidelines for our toilet. We didn't have a landlord. We made our decisions collectively. We had regular meetings where we voted on anything and everything to do with the house. It was a thumbs up, a thumb sideways, a thumbs down. It was our version of the way things should be. And then, in the fall of 2008, the rats came. They arrived in the twilight weeks of summer, and at first we underestimated them. We'd report rat sightings to each other at the mealtimes, assuming it was all the same rat, but how wrong we were. School started in late September, and the house was still in summertime mode, which means chaos and abandoned craft projects are just spilling out of the house's many nooks and crannies, and we couldn't have a cat either. People had allergies. Welcome to Rat City. Before I move on, you got to know something important about the Lorax. We made all of our decisions by consensus, and that means that a single no vote, one downward thumb, was enough to block a decision. So when the rats come up at one of the first house meetings, the poison and lethal traps get thumbed down immediately. Just because they live here doesn't mean we should kill them, someone says. So we try to find another solution. We do chores at full throttle. We turn the compost pile and bring it to the optimal temperature, about 130 degrees Fahrenheit. We catch a single rat in one of the life traps and we convince ourselves, hey, this is working. But we have no idea what's coming, where this rat infestation will push us, how it'll come to threaten the very existence of the Lorax, this miniature world we've created for ourselves, the world as we think it should be. It's early winter now. The rat infestation has become undeniable. The sense of urgency develops in the house, an urgency that wasn't there before. People start taking sides. On the anti-poison side, there's this couple, Leslie and Robert. On the pro-poison side, Carson. Now, Carson says the rats have already outsmarted us, that they'll be in the Lorax forever. It's happened at a previous house, he says, that he used to live at. The only way out is with force. Leslie responds with her own story about watching her childhood dog writhe in pain and then die after eating rat poison. The problem, of course, here is that neither side is wrong. We all signed up to live in the Lorax, anti-cruelty, philosophy, and all. But rats can carry deadly diseases. And while I may believe in the house's philosophy, I'm not about to die for it. So here we are, half the house willing to kill the rats, and the other half willing to sacrifice health and hygiene to save them. Meanwhile, as the house's solidarity crumbles away, the rodents are getting out of hand. I need to give you an idea of how bad it got. The tipping point comes in January when a squeaking rat dashes across a mattress while a couple is having sex, its tail brushing against bare skin. Here's a few more examples. One, a housemate discovers a rat in the compost pile, so fat and so lazy, it cannot run away from her. Just rolls out of the pile and shuffles away, glaring like its nap was rudely interrupted. It's like Templeton from Charlotte's Web retired and moved here for the complimentary buffet. Two, things get medieval when a rat is captured and brought outside to the alleyway between the Lorax and our vegetarian, cat-friendly neighbor co-op. A cat from next door is placed in front of the cage where the rat trembles inside. People gather around, leaning off porches in the brick alleyway to watch the fight like a sadistic Norman Rockwell painting. Three. One day, a 5-gallon tub of brown rice syrup, of course it's brown rice syrup, is opened to reveal a dead rat petrified inside. In its sedated eyes, you can read its final thought. This must be heaven. Four. Karen, who's the earliest riser in the house, turns on the kitchen lights one morning and finds the queen rat swaddled in a blanket of her own excess fat. The queen looks up from her meal of scraps and stares blankly back at Karen until she retreats from the kitchen. It's painfully clear now. We are living in their house. Some people take a passive approach to the rat problem. Others, like Carson, attack the infestation head on. He stays up all night in the attic, crouching with a 5-iron, waiting for a rat to scurry by and meet its maker. I'm not sure if he ever hit pay dirt with this method, and if he did, he definitely destroyed the evidence, but weirdly, it made me feel safe. I start spending less time in the house, hanging out instead in the college library and in my friend's rat-free house. At this point, all illusions of finding consensus are gone. There's a group of people who say they'll move out if we use poison, and another group that says they'll leave if we don't. The rats have been living with us for 9 months at this point. So, bitterly divided and hamstrung by our own decision-making process, we head out into the uncharted waters of democracy. Now, for us, that means we have to first vote by consensus to then vote democratically. I'll say that again. We voted by consensus to vote democratically. This is a big deal. We haven't done democracy yet at this house. We haven't had to. The motion barely passes with two sideways thumbs, and we decide to vote by majority at the next meeting. Fast forward one more week of dodging rats in the hallway, and it's time for the decision. We all gather for the meeting. Everyone closes their eyes for anonymity, and on the count of three, the thumbs go up. We vote. I'm facilitating, so it's up to me to scan the meeting and tally the votes. I look at people's faces as I count. Some look anxious, others look relaxed, relieved. Everybody looks ready to move on. The vote comes out in favor of using poison. Just like that, it's over. And true to their word, a small group of residents silently walk back upstairs and start packing their things to move out. The rest of us, we prepare to slaughter the rats. What just happened? I feel like I just walked out of a maze and discovered we're the lab rats. At that moment, I'm struck by a humbling realization. We failed, and the rats won. Faced with their extinction, they'll go down together, and we, the college-educated students, will fracture apart. In the days after the vote, two housemates lace peanut butter with poison and leave it around the house. It works. We start to notice a sharp decline in the rat population. But later that week, the fallout comes. The rats start to die, hidden in a vast network of tunnels throughout the house. The overwhelming stench of death seeps from the walls and hangs heavy in the air. And with that, the rats smoke us out once and for all, while they lay down to rest, finally, mercifully, at peace.
That story comes to us from Alex Ward. He's a writer and producer based in Portland, Oregon. You're listening to Unfictional on KCRW.com. I'm Bob Carlson, and today on the program, The Animal Inside. You can follow this program on Twitter, at Unfictional, or like us on Facebook if you'd like. Finally, on today's program, Law and Order and Goldfish. In the corner of a lot of kindergarten classrooms, you can usually find an animal of some kind, a hermit crab, a hamster. Caring for the animal is supposed to teach the kids about living with other species. But this one time in Jennifer Kim's elementary school classroom, there was a goldfish tank. And in trying to teach her kids to care for another species, Jennifer discovered something about taking care of a species that was entirely foreign to her. Children. From KCRW.com, it's Unfictional.
Miss Kim, there's a sticker in the fish tank. Someone put a sticker in the fish tank. This was a homework sticker. The kids got a little smiley face if they turned in all their work. Blue for Monday, red for Tuesday. At the end of the month, the smileys were tallied as points to claim a prize. I looked around at the 20 small faces, Richard, Vanessa, Abrar, Deepak, Eliana. They all looked like angels with pencils in their hands, but they weren't. Sitting at a big, old, wooden teacher's desk, I felt like a fraud. At age 30, I had hit the bamboo ceiling at my TV job. It's like the glass ceiling, but lower for Asians. So I had a friend who worked at an elementary school. I walked in for an interview. The charismatic Korean principal, who looked like Kim Jong-il, loved my media background. She hired me on the spot, even though I had no teaching experience. There was a major teacher shortage at the time, and I'm probably one of the few people who went into teaching for the money. If I were a parent, I definitely wouldn't want my child in my classroom. Soon I discovered I couldn't manage children. With none of my own or younger siblings, I had no clue. How could I figure out who put a sticker in the fish tank? My only example for justice-seeking was the TV show Law & Order. The process always seemed to go a little bit like this. Outright accuse, make up a crazy story, shake the table, use some muscle, threaten, and yell. First, I had to collect the evidence. Fish tank, Koreatown. I slowly unbent a paperclip and used its tip to fish the sticker out of the tank. I held up the sticker to the fluorescent lights and examined it. Then I placed the wet smiley carefully in my wooden desk drawer. All eyes were on me, which was rare. If I find any more stickers in the fish tank, you're all going to be in big trouble. This is not a nice thing to do to the fish. The fish is going to try to eat the sticker, which is not food, and that is going to kill it. I hope that my emphasis on certain words and my allusion to premeditated murder was enough. When the kids came back from recess, someone screamed again, "Miss Kim, there's another sticker in the fish tank." So then I decided to pound my desk on certain words. I firmly said, "The garbage can is for garbage, pound. The fish tank is for fish, pound. I think I know who did this, pound." The homework monitors were my key suspects. They were in charge of placing and peeling off the stickers on the folders. It was a powerful position and one that could easily be abused. Kidney-shaped table, Koreatown. I sat across 8-year-old Abrar, who wore glasses that darkened in the sun. He was cool and calm, as usual. "Why'd you do it?" "Do what?" "You're a homework monitor. You have access to the stickers. So why the fish tank?" Abrar immediately offered to look through the trash can. He dug through milk cartons and old gum and held up a few torn smileys on his index finger. This seemed to be the behavior of an innocent man, but I was not through. I asked him, "Why are you looking at me funny?" He replied, "Because you're looking at me funny." Abrar was the prescient child who, just after the 9/11 attacks, said that people would be mean to him because of how he looks. He was from Bangladesh and was Muslim. I suddenly felt very guilty and realized this must look really bad. I let him walk. Next up was high-strung Vanessa in her plaid maroon jumper. I decided to take a different tactic and appeal to family honor. I shook the kidney-shaped table slightly and said, "Tell me who did this. It's your duty as homework monitor to tell the truth. If you don't, I'll take away your job. How do you think your family would feel about this? Your mother." Vanessa was a straight-A student from a Mexican family of 4 sisters, all as anxious as her. She started bawling. I cut her loose. So these interviews got me no closer to the order part of Law & Order. In the show, if they convict the wrong person, he still gets sent to Rikers and usually dies there. The threat of Rikers was often enough to coerce some confessions. I, on the other hand, did not want to nail the wrong kid and be remorseful later. The code of silence in my 3rd grade class was unbreakable. I had to admire them for that. Once again, these 8-year-olds in school uniforms succeeded in testing me and chalked up another victory for themselves. By the end of the day, the 3rd grade sticker fish tank case remained unsolved. It would go on to become a cold case. I couldn't figure out the best way to serve justice, so I just said, heads down. But you know what? There was never another sticker in the tank after that. Maybe I was effective. Maybe I could be a teacher. Maybe I could even write my own Law & Order classroom management curriculum. Meanwhile, the goldfish was swimming around in its tank. "You're lucky to be alive," I thought. Lucky to be alive.
Jennifer Kim is a writer, still a teacher, and now a law student based in Los Angeles. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The editor is Nick White. The associate producer is Carla Green. I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional from KCRW.com.